Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Well, over the last few years, we've seen senators, Republican senators, really split over the budget and the size of the permanent fund dividend.
Political observers wonder if a coalition might take control of the Alaska Senate. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 3rd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, how statewide elections could impact Alaska's response to climate change.
Who is going to, at the bare minimum, just tackle the problems that Alaskans are facing right now?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
The makeup of the next Alaska legislature is as uncertain as ever after redistricting and with nearly every seat up for election. In both chambers, political observers are wondering if enough like-minded Republicans will get elected to form a majority or if there will be coalition majorities of moderate Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. It's been that kind of coalition in the House that in recent years has bucked parts of Republican Governor Mike Dunleavy's agenda. With Republicans showing divisions in the state Senate, there's speculation that a coalition majority could form there as well. At least that's what Alaska Beacon reporter James Brooks tells us. Brooks points to the state Senate's recent history.
Well, over the last few years, we've seen senators, Republican senators, really split over the budget and the size of the permanent fund dividend. And for the past few years, in fact, the only reason the Senate has been able to pass a budget is with Democratic votes. You had Republican senators voting against the budget written by other Republican senators, and that budget only passing the Senate because Democrats were willing to jump on board. Even though it hasn't been officially a coalition majority, it's been one in practice in terms of the budget.
Yeah, that's at least with the budget, seems like it looks a lot like a coalition, huh?
Yeah, and so now there's a greater thought that there could be an official coalition as there was in the early 2000s.
So before we talk about, you know, kind of what the potential makeup is there, what races are you watching the closest?
So there's 4 of the 19 that are on the ballot this year in the Senate that I think are going to go a long way to determining whether the Senate stays in a solidly Republican majority or a coalition majority. I think in Fairbanks, where you have Democratic incumbent Scott Kawasaki being challenged by former Fairbanks Mayor Jim Matherly, that's an important race. In West Anchorage, Democratic Representative Matt Klayman is challenging incumbent Republican Senator Mia Costello. In Eagle River, you have a race between 2 Republicans, Kelly Merrick and Ken McCarty, both Republican representatives. Merrick was a member of the House's coalition majority. She hasn't said officially that she would join a Senate coalition, but she's repeatedly said that it's important for voters in Eagle River to pick somebody who can work in a bipartisan way. And I've heard that language used by a few other Republican senators as perhaps hinting that they'd be willing to join a coalition. One of the Republicans who's used that language is Kathy Geisel in South Anchorage. If you recall, she was Senate president until she was defeated by another Republican, Roger Holland, who's now an incumbent trying to defend his seat against Geisel and a Democratic candidate.
Yeah. And like speaking of the primary, it's just the primary, not you know, maybe as many voters go to primaries as they do general elections, but it is a pretty good snapshot. It's a pretty big poll, you know, sample size. The races that you just mentioned, you know, how close were those in the primary?
Yeah. And how I tend to think of it is that there's a lot of weather vanes that we can look to when trying to figure out which way the wind's blowing in the general election. The primary result is one of those weather vanes. The demographics of the district are another weather vane. Does that district lean Republican? Does it lean Democratic? What are the fundraising totals? Is one candidate raising a lot more money than another candidate, which allows them to buy more ads, get their name out, all that? I tend to think of each of those as pointers in one direction or the other. A weather vane could point in the opposite direction of the other ones, but if a lot of them are pointing in the same direction, that's how I look at close, what I consider close races or not. And in these four or five, if you want to include Schauer and Massey, the primary election results indicated close results in the general election. Now, that could be a false indication if a lot more voters or different voters show up next week than we saw in August, but it's one weather vane pointing towards close races.
Right. As they say, that's why you play the game, to find out.
Exactly.
And I mean, with the uncertainty there, we really don't know what the makeup of the state Senate's going to be. I mean, we can talk about whether there may be a coalition majority or not, but this is all pretty far down the road, right, at this point.
Right. And we won't know on the 8th. We won't know that night or on Wednesday morning when you wake up. You shouldn't expect solid results because it's going to take 15 days for the last of the ballots to arrive from overseas. It always does. We have 15 days for absentee ballots to come in and to be counted, even without ranked choice voting. And then on the 23rd, the races with at least three or more candidates go through the ranked choice results. So we'll get results at that point. There could be court challenges in some of these races. Usually there's one or two. In the House, there's already two court challenges, one against Representative David Eastman that won't be resolved until December. There's potentially another West Anchorage State House race that won't be decided until after the election. A lawsuit's been filed there. And who knows what else will happen between now and then.
That was Alaska Beacon reporter James Brooks. What a difference a day makes. That's what Alaska Division of Elections Director Gail Fanumiai wrote in an email this morning, announcing that all of the polling precincts in the state will be staffed for Election Day next Tuesday. Yesterday morning, Fanumiai had asked media outlets to help get the word out that as many as 10 rural communities might not have workers for Election Day. Fanumiai was looking for help finding people to hire and train within the week. She says the Regional Elections Office in Nome, the Lieutenant Governor's Office, and the group Get Out the Native Vote worked together to find more poll workers.
Names were given and phone calls were made, and people, they decided they wanted to step up to make sure the voters in their community would have the opportunity to vote.
The timeline for training is tight, but Fanumiai says it will work out. She says if you try to vote on Election Day and for some reason your polling place is unstaffed, reach out to the Division of Elections as soon as possible. And if you need to find your polling place, that information is at elections.alaska.gov. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a program in Homer brings violin lessons to local students.
He's been interested in music since he was about 3, and I don't want him to lose that glow.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience. Your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Alaska is at the forefront of climate change in the U.S. It's warming faster here than any other state, and more than 60% of Alaskans say it's an issue they're concerned about. We asked candidates running for statewide office about their plans to address climate change, and their responses vary widely. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George reports.
Alaskans are already experiencing climate change in countless ways. A historic fall storm hit western Alaska this year, fueled by warming ocean temperatures. Permafrost thaw is buckling roads, and receding sea ice is making subsistence hunts more dangerous. At the same time, Alaska's economy is heavily dependent on oil and gas, which could explain why every candidate running for U.S. House and Senate and state governor says they support continued development in the state.
We need to drill, baby, drill.
Republican candidate for U.S. House Sarah Palin repeated her pro-development slogan at a debate last month, arguing that increasing oil production is the only way to bring down historic inflation. On a recent candidate survey, Palin called climate change a, quote, fraud. She also expressed doubts about increasing investment in renewable energy.
You know, a lot of the green energy projects, a lot of those are boondoggles. A lot of those are just some crony capitalism projects that politicians pass on to their friends.
Every statewide candidate we surveyed, except Palin, agreed that human activities are driving climate change. U.S. Senate candidate Kelly Chewbacca, U.S. House candidate Nick Begich, and Governor Mike Dunleavy, all Republicans, acknowledged the impacts of human activities, but said that shouldn't translate to scaling back resource development. Democratic gubernatorial candidate Les Guerra says he supports ConocoPhillips' Willow Project and selling Alaska's oil while it's still marketable. But at the same time, Guerra has been a loud proponent of ending oil tax credits as a way to fund state services and shift to clean energy. He's talked about investing in carbon sequestration for natural gas production and building more renewable energy projects across Alaska.
The world is asking for clean energy, right? They're not asking for 1960s energy anymore. We have to catch up with the world.
Democratic House Representative Mary Paltola, also a Willow Project supporter, says Alaska is uniquely positioned to be a leader in tackling climate change. She's promised to fight for funding to support renewable energy development and study the salmon and halibut collapse in western Alaska, which has been linked to climate change. Pasha Madavi is an associate professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who researches environmental politics. He says while Alaska is feeling the brutal environmental impacts of climate change, it's also contending with the economic impacts of a world that is slowly transitioning out of fossil fuels.
That's a distinction that kind of exists across these races. You know, who is going to, at the bare minimum, just tackle the problems that Alaskans are facing right now? And then who's going to not only do that, but allow the state to thrive in the context of the transition?
Dunleavy and Chewbacca are less focused on pulling away from fossil fuels. They say oil and gas development should happen at the same time as investment in renewables. Here's Chewbacca at a recent debate.
I don't think we take an either-or approach, though, to those of us who want clean air, clean water, and clean land.
Both say that energy produced in Alaska is a, quote, cleaner option than relying on sources elsewhere in the world. In a candidate questionnaire, Dunleavy noted, for example, Alaska has laws against flaring or venting natural gas. He wrote, quote, stopping resource production in Alaska will only push it to other places with fewer environmental safeguards, end quote. Dunleavy says Alaska can be a leader in renewable energy at the same time.
We are doing everything we can, and we are, on renewables. AEA has got hundreds of millions of dollars, I should say, going towards renewable projects across Alaska.
Madavi says across the country, Americans are more concerned about climate change than ever, but candidates are split in how they're talking about it. And it's the same in Alaska. Democrats, he says, are more often discussing the environmental and economic impacts of climate change than their Republican counterparts. In Alaska, he says, that translates to a conversation where some candidates are willing to discuss a future when oil and gas is less relevant, and others aren't. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
Local police and Alaska State Troopers responded to Lathrop High School in Fairbanks yesterday for what turned out to be a fake active shooter report. Fairbanks Police Department spokesperson Teal Soden says they were alerted just before 2 p.m. about something happening at the school.
FPD received a 911 call from someone who reported that there was an active shooter at Lathrop High School and that students had been shot. FPD, as well as other area law enforcement officers, immediately responded to the school. They cleared the school. There was no confirmation that there was any active shooter or that there were any injuries. At this time, it appears to have been a hoax call.
According to a message sent out by Fairbanks North Star Borough School District Chief Administrator Karen Moline, Lathrop High, as well as nearby Hunter Elementary, Ryan Middle, and Barnett Magnet Schools were all locked down. A fuzzy video shared on social media appears to show police detaining someone. Soden confirms that officers encountered a student as they entered the school and that he was checked for firearms and put into a secure classroom. She says the student was not handcuffed or otherwise restrained and that the same thing happened with a couple other students. A police officer was at Lathrop this morning, and the school district also had an emotional support team on site. It's illegal, of course, to make a fake 911 call, and Soden says the hoax shooter call is being investigated.
It may depend on the carrier or if the person has found a way to block their phone number, but generally speaking, if somebody called here locally from a cell phone, there's a pretty good chance that, you know, and if their phone number is not blocked, there's a pretty good chance that they could see where they're at. But at this point, it does, you know, there's no indication or proof right now that it was even a local call.
Soden says the investigation will likely be turned over to the FBI. Anchorage police responded to a similar hoax call about an active shooter at Eagle River High School yesterday. And a similar fake shooter or bomb threat calls have been happening around the country. The Anchorage School Board has approved a three-year contract between the district and Teamsters Local 959, the union that represents some of its bus drivers. The contract increases hourly pay and contributions to drivers' health care plans. It also gives drivers more opportunities to pick up extra work and earn overtime pay. Union spokesperson Derek Musto told the board that drivers play an important role in the district.
These professionals are the first and last non-household adults that our children see each day, and they play a vital role in security for our school district and our community.
He also noted that bus drivers often work unpredictable hours for just 9 months of the year. The district had been paying drivers $7 to $9 less per hour than the city's bus program and tour companies. Bargaining for the new contract began in April. School board member Carl Jacobs said the wage increases and other improvements were a long time coming.
I wanted to, apologize to the Teamster members that this took this long. A contract that had appropriate terms, given the level of service and sacrifice by these public service members, is long overdue.
The contract is in effect through June 2025.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The general election is November 8th. Polls are open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. You will be voting for U.S. Senator, U.S. Representative, Governor, Lieutenant Governor, State Senators, State Representatives, and Judges. When you go vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the precinct register or you do not have ID, you may vote a questioned ballot. The questioned ballot updates your voter registration record. If you need language assistance or other assistance while voting, ask an election worker or bring someone to assist you. For assistance in Alaska Native languages, please call 1-866-954-8683. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Elections.
Federal aviation regulators are directing carriers to inspect a popular model of bush plane before their next flight. In an airworthiness directive published Wednesday in the Federal Register, the Federal Aviation Administration says operators of de Havilland DHC-3 Otters must take a close look at a component that controls the horizontal portion of the plane's tail. Crash investigators at the National Transportation Safety Board called on the FAA to mandate the inspections last week. That's after an investigation into a crash in Washington State indicated the horizontal stabilizer actuator, or jack screw, had come apart before an otter plunged into Puget Sound. The FAA says it's concerned other planes could have the same issue. Under the FAA directive, operators are required to look closely at the actuator to ensure that a lock ring that prevents the component from coming apart is properly installed. The directive also requires operators to send the results of the inspection to the FAA. The Tesla name evokes images of sleek electric cars and eccentric billionaires. In Soldotna, a fleet of Tesla batteries is helping with a mundane but important task, regulating the Kenai Peninsula's supply of electricity. KDLL Sabine Pooks has more.
Stamped with the red Tesla logo, rows and rows of padlocked white containers hum behind a chain fence at Homer Electric Association's generation facility in Soldotna. Behind every door is a handful of lithium-ion batteries.
So you can see, actually, there's four of them all together.
Larry Jorgensen is director of power, fuels, and dispatch at Homer Electric.
Each megapack has about 2.5 megawatt hours of storage in it. So, and then there's 37 of them all together, as you see here. And then
for perspective, he says that's enough to power 925,000 100 watt light bulbs, or in Tesla terms.
I think Brad J., our general manager, uses the example that, this is the equivalent of 970 Teslas. Cars parked out here charging and discharging.
The Tesla batteries are part of Homer Electric Association's Battery Energy Storage System, or BESS, a facility that stores a constant supply of power for the utility's grid. Jorgensen says the biggest use for the BESS is to regulate the system.
You can imagine, like, if you're driving your vehicle on the road, if you are constantly accelerating, decelerating, it's not going to be a very efficient way to drive. And so by doing this, we can drive the power plants at a very constant rate and let the BESS take the changes.
It has other uses, too. The BESS is a backup source of power if the system goes offline. For example, if a wildfire damages transmission lines, batteries can still store energy for later use. David Thomas with Homer Electric says the BESS also has the potential to stabilize irregular renewable energy sources like solar and wind. Batteries could capture that energy in times of surplus for other times when there's less available.
But we are modeling our battery use for future incorporation of solar and intermittent wind energy.
Staff and board members from the utility cut the ribbon on the BESS facility at a ceremony this week. But Thomas says the BESS has been up and running since January. So how's it been going?
Fine. It's kind of boring. They just sit there like batteries, and they charge and discharge. They're highly programmable to multiple different modes, but there's really nothing to look at, just some 37 white boxes sitting there on their concrete pads. But
Homer Electric isn't the only utility using BESS technology to prevent blackouts and increase efficiency. Golden Valley Electric, the utility in Fairbanks, has been using its own battery system for almost two decades. When it first came online in 2003, it was the largest battery in the world. But Thomas says since Golden Valley brought its system online, system price points and capacity have improved dramatically.
This unit is 8 times larger and is in no way the largest anymore. This is a run-of-the-mill energy storage system as batteries go around the world now.
But Tesla, for its part, says its battery pack technology is in high demand nationwide today, as more utilities are turning toward renewable energy. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
For the first time, kindergarten and first grade students in Anchor Point are learning how to play the violin at school. That's thanks to the nonprofit Homer Opus. It expanded its violin program to Chapman Elementary School last month with help from a grant from Carnegie Hall. The program is inspired by the El Sistema music program from Venezuela and puts violins in the hands of young people, aiming to use music education as a vehicle for social change. KBBI's Hope McKinney reports the school-based violin program has been active in Homer schools for about a decade, and Anchor Point parents say they're happy to see the program expand to their own children.
Now stick it to the glue, but not, don't burn your fingers.
Mom, can you hold it still?
Yes. 3 dozen kindergartners and first graders, accompanied by their guardians, wield hot glue guns and cardboard cutouts of violins in the gym at Chapman Elementary in Anchor Point. They're making three-dimensional instruments that they'll paper mache and later paint, and then use to learn rhythm, finger positions, and technique. And maybe most importantly, how to take care of an instrument.
Well, I I'm making a cardboard violin. I'm gonna pretend it's a real violin.
5-year-old Jack O'Leary is a kindergartner at Chapman. He's here at the gym with his grandma, Sandy. These dummy violins, like the one Jack's making, will be these students' close companions over the next couple months. This is the first step in the school's new violin program. First, the kindergartners and first graders get to know their cardboard violins, and next semester, they'll get their own real wooden ones, which they'll practice in class twice a week. Sandy, the grandma, is thrilled. She says she couldn't find a violin teacher for Jack and Homer, which is about 15 miles from Anchor Point. So this is huge.
I think music is very important. He's been interested in music since he was about 3, and I don't want him to lose that glow.
Clayton Holland is superintendent for the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District. The district partners with Homer Opus, the nonprofit which runs the in-school violin programs. He says when he first became aware of the program, he noticed how inclusive it was of every student, regardless of ability or financial status.
Part of that, and the difference it made in them, in their confidence, their leadership, their understanding of working together.
Holland says a program like Opus coming into schools is important, especially at a time when school budgets are being cut across the state and nation. Miranda Weiss is on the board of directors of Homer Opus. Weiss says the goal of Opus is not to create professional musicians, but for students to develop cognitive and social skills.
These are the sort of brain and learning skills like perseverance or self-control and things like leadership and teamwork. And so that's why we start with the youngest kids, and that's really what we're after, is helping kids become better learners and also better citizens. And then as they get older in the programs, we add skills of musicianship, and we're really fostering lifelong love of music.
That seems to have worked for students in Homer. 16-year-old Maggie Mae Gaylord started playing violin at age 4. Now she plays with the Bayside Buskers, a youth ensemble composed mostly of current and former Opus students. They've performed at places like the local senior center, hospital, and animal shelter. Gaylord says music has brought her focus and discipline, but also much more than that.
For me, music is a community thing. It's a way to connect with people and, you know, play music with my friends and also kind of give back to the community.
Homer Opus's mission is to build a stronger community by creating music together. Abimael Melendez is Opus's new string program director. He grew up in Venezuela, where he fell in love with the violin thanks to the El Sistema program, which inspired the Opus model.
I was so dedicated, and that moment I knew that after high school I wanted to dedicate my life to the music.
Melendez is teaching kindergartners and first graders violin at Chapman Elementary this year. Opus hopes to add second graders into the program next school year. Reporting in Anchor Point and Homer, I'm Hope McKenney.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Jeremy Shea and Kavitha George in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Eric Stone in Ketchikan, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, and Hope McKenney in Anchor Point and Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Emmert. Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
And by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, offering guests hot breakfast, Wi-Fi, and the Red Lantern Steak and Spirits Restaurant. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.